Listen, sister, you've been out here for days. This is hopeless. There's no point in you wasting your time for a reply if you actually think someone's gonna fall in love with you over a poem that you toss into the sea. You're wrong.
No, you're wrong. It wasn't just any poem. It was my soul, and anyone who reads it will know the real me, my true beauty, and all my secrets. It would have been as if they were within me.
Oh, great. Love consummated with a bottle. And what makes you so sure you're even going to find this thing? I mean, the sea covers 3/4 of this planet.
Well, it's so conspicuous, it can't help but be seen. No other bottle is like it. Fluorescent pink with glow-in-the-dark polka dots.
You mean like this one?
Oh, yes, that's it. Where did you get it?
Oh, I've been carrying it around for days. I was saving it for a fish float or something. I didn't know that you were going to...
Give me that. The reply, it's here. Oh, I can't believe it. And if you had it all this time, well, I could just kill you. Oh, look. It's in cursive. Such sensitive handwriting. Oh, my love, speak to me.
Well, read it. What does it say?
Wait, I don't understand. This doesn't...
What does it say?
Well, it says... Mystery Playhouse is sponsored by a...
Sid quote, Mystery Playhouse is sponsored by Comics and Comics Toys and Games at 405 California Avenue, unquote. We now return you to the music of Raymond Raquello, playing for you...
Those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast.
Now here's another bulletin from Washington, D.C.
Martial law prevails throughout. Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make.
So that we may confront this destructive adversary.
Everything wiped out. This may be the last broadcast. We'll stay here to the end.
There is nothing wrong with your radio. Do not attempt to change the station. We are controlling the transmission. We control the volume. We can change the tone to a fuzzy bass. Or focus it to a tinny treble.
We can speed things up so fast you can hardly understand what's being said.
Or we can make things so slow you don't care.
We control the content. We can make it boring.
Mystery Playhouse.
Or moronic.
90.1.
We can even make it repetitive.
Mystery Playhouse.
Or moronic.
90.1.
We can even make it repetitive. It's our show. We can do anything we want, because this is...
Mystery Playhouse. 90.1.
Having trouble sleeping at night? Why not try?
The wonderful world of folk music.
I wonder how many of you remember the big folk music scare of the 60s. Boy, that was close. That garbage almost caught on. You know, the other day I was sitting around and thinking, I wonder what the first music ever written in this great country of ours was. And I was certainly hoping it wasn't that fiddle and banjo crap. Lord knows we've come further than that. So rather than think, I decided to look it up. And I looked it up in the Encyclopedia Britannica. You know, the way I got into the Britannica is kind of an interesting digression in itself. I was on the road as a performer, and, well, we'd stopped in a small town and a hotel room. A perfect hotel room, really, with a big double bed, soft lights, but let's face it, something was missing. And that night, I have to confess, I got lucky. I was actually able to find what I thought was a really good book. It was called Girl to Grab. Imagine my surprise when I found out it was volume 6 of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And imagine my delight when the book opened up its wonders to me. Golf carts, glowworms, Giselle McKenzie. Incredible. So I looked up folk music and was very delighted to find out I was quite right. It wasn't that fiddle and banjo crap at all. In fact, the first music made in this country wasn't even made in this country. It was made a few miles offshore by Columbus and his merry men as they were sailing to our new land. Imagine what that was like. No instruments, just singing a cappella. Just imagine what it was like.
Captain Columbus.
Yes, Malarkey?
The men haven't eaten in days, sir.
Yes, Malarkey.
Captain, I don't think you fully understand. I said the men have not eaten in days now.
I heard you, Malarkey. Thank you.
Captain, you've gone quite mad. I'm telling you for the last time, the men have not eaten in days.
Well, force them! You've plenty of men, haven't you?
Plenty, sir.
Plenty of what, sir?
Men, sir.
What?
Men.
What?
Men.
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 Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men. Men.
It's great to be on a ship with men and sail across the sea. Oh, we don't know where we'll land or when, but it's great to be with men.
It's great to be with men.
Cause men can sweat and men can stink and no one seems to care. Oh, we'll throw the dishes in the sink and clog the drain with hair. Oh,
clog the drain with hair. Oh, men, men, men. It's a ship all filled with men. So batten down the ladies' room. There's no one here but men.
Men, 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 men.
There's men above, there's men below, there's men down in the galley, there's Butch,
and Five,
and Blue,
and Biff,
and one guy we call Sally,
and one guy we call Sally.
Men, 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 it's a ship all filled with men, you'll never have to lift a seat, there's no one here but men.
Men, 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 men.
We're men and friends until the end, and none of us are sissies. At night we sleep in separate beds and blow each other kisses,
and blow each other kisses. Men, 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 it's a ship all filled with men, so throw your rubbers overboard, there's no one here but men.
Ah.
Mate, eight bells and all's well. First Mate Bob and the crew of the good ship Grace, the voices from the harbor called Haven of Rest. I'm told that everybody likes a story. Every life is a story, and mine is no exception. May I share it with you? The story of my conversion to Christ in 1934, and I shall begin the narration right after this good song. Listen.
Got a whale of a tale to tell you, lads, a whale of a tale or two, about the flapping fish and the girls I've loved on nights like this with the moon above. A whale of a tale, and it's all true, I swear by my tattoo. There was Harpoon Hannah, had a look that spelled out danger. My heart quivered when she whispered, "Hi there, stranger." Bought her trinkets that sailors can't afford. When I spent my last red cent. She tossed me overboard. Got a whale of a tale to tell you, lads, a whale of a tale or two about the flapping fish and the girls I've loved on nights like this with a moon above. A whale of a tale, and it's all true, I swear by my tattoo.
The year 1866 was signalized by a remarkable incident, a mysterious and inexplicable phenomenon which doubtless no one has yet forgotten. Not to mention rumors which agitated the marine population and excited the public mind, even in the interior of continents, seafaring men were particularly excited. Merchants, common sailors, captains of vessels, skippers, both of Europe and America, naval officers of all countries and the governments of several states on the two continents were deeply interested in the matter. For some time past, vessels had been met by an enormous thing, a long object, spindle-shaped, occasionally phosphorescent, and infinitely larger and more rapid in its movements than a whale. The facts relating to this apparition, entered in various logbooks, agreed in most respects as to the shape of the object or creature in question, the untiring rapidity of its movements, its surprising power of locomotion, and the peculiar life with which it seemed endowed. If it was a cetacean, it surpassed in size all those hitherto classified in science. Taking into consideration the mean of observations made at divers times, rejecting the timid estimate of those who assigned to this object a length of 60 meters, equally with the exaggerated opinions which set it down as 2 kilometers in width and 6 kilometers in length, we might fairly conclude that this mysterious being surpassed greatly all dimensions admitted by the ichthyologist of the day, if it existed at all. And that it did exist was an undeniable fact. And with that tendency which disposes the human mind in favor of the marvelous, we can understand the excitement produced in the entire world by this supernatural apparition. As to classing it in the list of fables, the idea was out of the question. At the period when these events took place, I had just returned from a scientific research in the disagreeable territory of Nebraska in the United States. In virtue of my office as assistant professor in the Museum of Natural History in Paris, the French government had attached me to that expedition. After 6 months in Nebraska, I arrived in New York towards the end of March, laden with a precious collection. My departure for France was fixed for the first days in May. Upon my arrival in New York, several persons did me the honor of consulting me on the phenomenon in question. I had published in France a work in quarto in 2 volumes entitled Mysteries of the Great Submarine Grounds. This book, highly approved of in the learned world, gained for me a special reputation in this rather obscure branch of natural history. My advice was asked. I replied that I should be disposed to admit the existence of a gigantic narwhal. The common narwhal, or unicorn of the sea, often attains a length of 20 meters. Increase its size 5-fold or 10-fold, give it strength proportionate to its size, lengthen its destructive weapons, and you obtain the animal required. The industrial and commercial papers treated the question chiefly from my point of view. Public opinion had been pronounced. The United States was the first in the field, and in New York they made preparations for an expedition destined to pursue this narwhal.
Sing ho!
Hoist the mainsail!
Clear the forward mast! All secure for sea!
The crew raised the anchor, the wind caught our sails, and off we moved into the Pacific in search of an unknown enemy. I noticed the 2 other special passengers and walked over to meet them. Oh, I'm Ned Land.
I am Professor Aronnax, and this is my nephew, Conseil.
I'm glad to know both of you.
Uncle is a scientist. He wants to find the monster.
Yeah, so do I. What do you think it is, Professor?
Well, some say it is a giant whale. Others say it is a giant animal that flies up out of the water to attack its prey. I have my own ideas.
And if we meet this monster, Professor, what will you do?
Well, I am a scientist. I will study the monster and prepare reports so that the world will know of this new creature. Besides getting valuable scientific information, I can do my part to help stop all of the false rumors that have been frightening people.
And you, Conceal?
Me? Oh, I'm not afraid of any old monster.
That's pretty good, Flipper.
Sandy and his dolphin Flipper have been close friends for a long time, and Sandy wishes that every day could be like this forever.
That's it, Flipper. Now into the basket again.
But the land Sandy and his father have been calling home really belongs to the state. And the planning commissioners have decided to build a causeway which will run right through where the Ricks' father and son have been living. While Sandy's father is away at Park Ranger School, one of the neighbors, Mr. L.C. Porritt, has been keeping an eye on the boy. Today, he brings sad news for Sandy.
Sandy!
Oh, hi, Mr. Porritt. Come on and join the game.
I haven't time. I've got to talk to you.
Okay. Be back in a minute, Flipper. Yes, sir?
Sandy, how'd you like to go on a trip?
To see my pa?
No, he's still training to be a ranger in that new underwater park. You're going to live with your aunt until he gets back.
But he'll be gone 6 more weeks. Who'll look after Flipper?
Oh, you won't have to worry at all. Flipper will have the best care in the world. The folks from the Miami Seaquarium are coming to take him there. They'll be arriving in an hour.
But nobody can take Flipper. I won't let them, that's all.
Well, the state road gangs will be bulldozing through here tomorrow. There'll be no place for you or Flipper to stay. Flipper has to go to the Seaquarium, and you to your Aunt Matilda's.
I gotta talk to Pa.
He can't be reached, Sandy. I tried. He's off on a diving exercise.
Mr. Porritt, Flipper has to go where I go.
But there's no more water at your aunt's than you can pump from the well. And Flipper can't live in a bucket. I'll be back in an hour to help you get ready.
But Mr. Porritt...
I'm sorry, son. There's nothing more we can do.
It is a cold night along a deserted section of the rugged coast of England. A lone and menacing figure is approaching the Admiral Benbow Inn, a place not too many people visit, for it is far from town. It is here that we begin our story, Treasure Island.
This here's a quiet cove. Much company, mate?
Not
much. Who'd be the owner?
My mother.
Where is your mother?
In the town.
What's your name?
Jim Hawkins.
Well, Jim, you seems a likely lad. Ever notice a seafaring man alongside this here grog shop?
Not many come out so far, sir.
None by the name of Captain William Bones?
Bones, sir?
No matter. Fill her up.
As the mysterious man with a scarred face lifted his glass, he silently looked around the room and discovered a trunk beneath the stairway with the letters WB. Upon pushed out the door.
Jim. Was it a one-leg man?
No, sir. But he had a terrible scar.
Black dog. When you sees black dog, you lay to it. The man with the one leg ain't far off. Rum, Jim. Fetch me rum.
I can't, Captain. I promised Dr. Livesey.
Oh, hang all doctors. Give me rum.
It was a night in midwinter in the city of San Diego, California, down along the waterfront where there was little or no activity. Occasionally, a taxicab would flash into view, only to disappear around the corner of a deserted street. Against a foggy sky, The riding lights of varied types of craft moved in monotonous rhythm with the rise and fall of the restless water. As far as I could see, I was alone. Not another human being in sight, as on and on I trudged. Long hours before I'd begun this aimless wandering, and now, weary in body and mind and sick of soul, I still was as bewildered and lost as ever. Memories like haunting ghosts of all the dead yesterdays followed my every footstep. The faces of my wife and four children kept appearing again and again upon the screen of my consciousness. How were they tonight? I'd left them alone and helpless. A nearby piling offered a seat that I might rest my aching feet. The cardboard which I'd placed in my shoes to protect my feet where the soles were worn through had long since ceased to serve its purpose. Only the lapping of the water against the wharf broke the stillness of the night. The sudden clanging of a ship's bell startled me. 2, 4, 6, 8. 8 bells. That must be 4 o'clock in the morning. I'd walked all night in a sort of alcoholic stupor, for I'd been drinking heavily, trying to forget.
Please, Captain Bones. Doctor said it'd kill you. If you don't stop, I'll run to town for the doctor. And the squire, too.
Gotta get my strength back, Jim. Got to pull out of here.
Jim was determined to fetch the doctor, but was stopped at the door by a blind man wearing a black cloak.
Now then, boy, take me to Captain Billy Bones or I'll break your arm. Straight to him now. March. Here's a friend for you, Bill.
It's Pew.
Pew as ever was, Bill. Back with a gift from all your old shipmates. Boy, take him by the wrist and bring his hat close to mine. And now, that's done.
What's rightful mine is mine. Give me a hand, Jim. We'll do that one-legged man yet.
The black spot, the mark of the pirate's vengeance. Captain Billy Bones knew they would be back. Quickly, he asked Jim to open his trunk and remove a withered yellow piece of paper. He told Jim to keep the paper from the pirates at all cost and beckoned him to run for help. Run, Jim did. But by the time he returned with his friends, Dr. Livesey and Squire Trelawney, it was too late. The pirates had already performed their foul deed. The Admiral Benbow Inn had been searched from top to bottom, and Captain Billy Bones was dead.
Nothing we can do? Nothing you can do, maybe.
As he walks to the edge of the wharf, Sandy thinks of a desperate plan. Then, because Flipper's out in deep water catching a mid-morning snack, Sandy picks up his klaxon horn to call his dolphin.
Flipper? Well, I'm sorry, Flipper. No more basketball now. We have to leave. Both of us. Wait right here while I get some supplies and a chart from the house. We've got only a few minutes to get away.
Sandy quickly throws whatever canned food he can find into a sea bag. Then, going to his father's nautical charts, he searches until he finds one marked Chart of the Bahamas and West Indies Islands. Then he runs down to the wharf where his skiff is tied.
After throwing everything into the boat and checking to see that both gas tanks are full, he notices that Flipper is gone again.
Flipper? Flipper? Okay. Ready to go, Flipper. Stay right with me, remember.
Sandy lays the klaxon horn on the wharf and gets ready to start the motor. All day, under the blazing sun, Sandy steers the skiff toward the southeast.
For endless days and nights, we searched the South Pacific. Our hopes began to dim. The crew went about their normal duties, but I could see in their eyes that they were becoming nervous about this unknown creature. To help them pass the time and feel a little more relaxed, they would sit around the deck and tell stories about the sea. Conseil and I would often sit with them. He enjoyed hearing their adventures in far-off lands. Little did he know at that time that he was about to become part of an adventure much greater than the stories he had heard. And then one evening the wind began to suddenly blow harder and harder. We ran into a tropical hurricane. The ship began rolling and bouncing like a cork in the water. The mizzenmast broke in two.
Abandon ship!
We're sinking!
Abandon ship!
Quick, Conseil! Professor, into this life
boat! All right, Ned.
We are secure!
All right, here we go. We'll have to row fast to clear the ship before she goes under, or else she'll pull us down with her.
We are clear!
We began looking for fellow survivors, but found none. The rest of the crew either went down with the ship or escaped in some other direction. Well, I guess it's the three of us in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I just hope we don't meet that monster now. For 2 days, we drifted in the South Seas. The hurricane had blown itself out. This was followed by a terrible calm around us. The sea was quiet and beautiful, but we were all more concerned with being rescued.
Ned, what are we going to do? I'm sure hungry.
Well, mate, about the only thing we can do is keep rowing and hope we sight something.
If only the lifeboat supplies had not been lost in the escape.
It sure gets hot out here.
You got to remember you're in the South Seas. Out here, it's hot 1 minute, and the next minute could bring a tropical storm.
Look! What's that over there?
I don't know, but we'll soon find out. Conseil had noticed a strange-looking object way off on the horizon. We started for it right away. Maybe this was our chance for rescue. At first, we thought it was an island, but as we got closer, we knew that it was anything but an island.
Uncle, look! It must be the monster!
Oui, Conseil. I think you are right.
What we had found was not a giant monster whale or some huge flying fish, but what appeared to be some sort of a man-made submarine.
How vividly now I recall the many times my sweet Christian wife had pleaded with me to accept as my personal savior the Lord Jesus Christ, whom she knew and loved so well. Her prayers and those of my children had followed me, I knew, all the years of my life. So far, my proud heart had rebelled against a full and complete surrender. I had gone my own willful way, and to a marked degree, I had been successful in business. I'd become well known in radio circles and finally had been appointed to an important position on the Pacific Coast as the commercial manager of two radio stations in Southern California. Now, all this was a thing of the past. I was face to face with the dead-end street of life at 8 bells in the morning watch. Eight bells. That was the end of the long night watch, and soon it would be morning. Morning, to me, meant just another dreary day. All at once it dawned upon me that this morning would be Sunday morning. The people of San Diego would be gathering for Sunday school and church. Church. How long had it been since I had sat in a church and heard a sermon and joined in worship? So long I couldn't remember. I used to sing in a choir long ago. Perhaps if I could find someone who would pray with me, there would come some peace to my troubled heart and soul. That was it. I needed God. I remembered Mother's oft-told tale of the prodigal son. If ever there was a prodigal son, it was I.
Dead as doomsday, but he wasn't killed. He died of shock. Or rum.
I wonder what those rascals wanted of him.
I think I can tell you, Squire Trelawney. Now he's dead, I can.
That's my life. Doctor! Flint's map! How did you come by it, lad?
Why, he gave it to me, sir, when he sent me for help. He said I'd share.
Share what? You don't know. Pirate treasure man. Flint's gold. Why, everybody knows of the ships Flint plundered. That fellow must have been the only one who knew where the treasure was hid. So that's what those scoundrels wanted, the map of Flint's treasure island. Latitude, longitude, crosses to mark the deposits, money to roll in. You're a trump, young Hawkins. Mark my words, you will share.
The next day, Squire Trelawney set out for the seaport town of Bristol to make arrangements for a ship, a captain, and crew to sail for the most fabulous pirate treasure ever, Flint's Gold.
All during the following morning, Sandy steers the boat into a stiff breeze, and progress against the choppy waves is painfully slow. Around noon, with the hot sun beating down relentlessly, the first tank of gasoline is empty.
It's okay, Flipper. Nothing to worry about. I'll just hook on this second tank of gas. There. We're all set. Here goes.
After another night on the open sea and half of another day, Sandy's food is gone. And there is no gasoline left in the second tank.
Yeah, things look pretty bad now, Flipper. But there's an island way over there. I can just make out the trees. I'll have to try to row the rest of the way. Might as well get out the oars. Hey, that's a great idea. If I give you part of the anchor rope, you'll try pulling me along. Okay, here, catch. I'll row at the same time. That way neither one of us will get too tired. Let's go.
There doesn't seem to be anyone around.
I must go aboard and seize this wonderful machine. This is something that man has always dreamed of in order to explore the mysteries of the deep. A submarine.
We tied the lifeboat to the side of the ship and carefully started walking along the top of this unknown vessel. Through one of the portholes, we could see all kinds of instruments, dials, levers, and other controls. Finally, we came to an open hatch. Hello! Hello, anyone down there?
We must go below and see what this ship is like.
Uncle, don't you think it would be better if we waited to see if someone comes up first?
That's all right, Conceal. Besides, since it is a ship that is able to go underwater, it could do so any moment.
Well, I suppose you're right.
Conseil and I followed Professor Aronnax down the hatchway, which was a long, winding stairway. This stairway led to a balcony overlooking what was probably the control room. Here we saw more dials and instruments, plus lights that kept blinking on and off like signals. We walked slowly through the passageway, which led into one of the most luxurious rooms I had ever imagined. This main room had deep, rich carpets, shelves of books, beautiful paintings, a fountain spurting water in the middle of the room, and at the other end, a huge pipe organ. It was a sight like I had never seen.
Ah, this is beautiful. I wonder what sort of men were able to make a ship like this.
Uncle, Ned, look over here at this big window. There are the people.
The professor and I rushed over to this large window to see Conseil's discovery. The window looked out onto the ocean floor, and we could see a procession of strangely dressed creatures in underwater diving suits walking in line and carrying something. They stopped and set what they were carrying on the ocean floor, and each man placed a piece of coral near the object. The leader folded his hands as if in prayer.
I entered the open door of a large church, whose bell had heralded the morning worship up and down the streets of the city. Eagerly I sat and listened to the organ, the choir, and the preliminary rituals. The pews were filled with well-dressed men and women who had come to listen to the word of God. At last, the minister began his sermon. Then it was all over. The benediction had been pronounced. The choir had sung its last amen, and people were slowly filing out. No one had spoken a word to me. No mention had been made in the morning message of a Savior who could rescue a lost soul. The whole meeting had been so coldly formalistic that I had not detected one friendly smile. Not one hand of greeting had been extended to me. I was stunned. Dazed, I found my way back to the cheap hotel room where I'd been sleeping. I was desperate. Suddenly, my eyes were focused upon a book. It was a Gideon Bible placed there by that great band of Christian businessmen known the world over. I had carelessly noticed its presence before, but now it seemed to hold out to me a faint ray of hope. Opening its pages, I placed it upon a chair and knelt before it. I do not recall reading one single word. I simply began to pour out my heart to God, acknowledging my guilt as a sinner and declaring my faith in Jesus Christ to save my soul.
I didn't waste my time poring over his credentials. All the credentials I needed was a taste of his ham and his buttered eggs. You can judge for yourself.
Top of the morning, gentlemen.
Ahoy, John Silver.
Sit ye down at table to starboard, if ye kindly will.
After they had settled down for the meal, Jim's face was suddenly stricken with horror. Long John Silver had only one leg. Could this be the one-legged man that Captain Billy Bones had feared so much? Long John saw the look in the boy's eyes and knew he must put the three men in his trust, even to saying he had once sailed with an admiral.
You run your house well, my man, and you keep a good table, too.
Thank you kindly, sir.
It isn't often I see fruit in an English tavern for breakfast.
Ah. It's a rule of health I learned while sailing under the Immortal Ark. When you shipped with the admiral, you never took scurvy from the salt pork and hard. Not with a barrel of apples aboard for the men that you are.
There's sense in that, Trelawney. Something we could profit by.
And well, by gad, there'll be apples on my ship, too.
You favors the admiral yourself, squire, if I may say so. Why, you and he could make up your mind like that.
What now?
That he do, sir. I've noticed it afore. It wouldn't surprise me none to hear you say, heave at the anchor. We sails on the hour.
Can't sail without a crew. All the hemming and hawing that goes on, you'd think there wasn't an honest seaman to be had in Bristol.
I begs to differ, sir, if I may make so bold. Why, there's a full cargo of my old shipmates has sailed with Ark, becalmed right here in Bristol. Sound men inside, if some of them was scarred in the service of England. And they with no pensions neither.
Could a score of those foremast hands be had on short notice?
Aye, sir, but they wouldn't be pretty enough for the modern taste. Nowadays, they fix the younger men by the cut of their jib, not the old uns for their experience.
Appearances be hanged. Silver, get me those men.
Soon, our unknown hosts had returned. The captain discovered us all in the main room.
Gentlemen, welcome to the Nautilus. You are the guests of Captain Nemo.
Well, thank you. You see, we were adrift inside of your vessel.
Ah, it is a pleasure to meet you, Capitaine. Allow me to introduce myself and my friends. I am Professor Aronnax. This is my nephew, Conseil, and this is Monsieur Ned Land.
Gentlemen, from now on, the Nautilus is your home. You may never set foot on shore.
Never again set foot on shore?
But how will we live?
The undersea world supplies us with everything.
Well, I'm hungry. Can I have a steak and vegetables?
Of course. It won't be steak and vegetables, but I'll arrange a meal for you from under the sea. Things that you have never eaten before. Some of which will taste just like steak and vegetables.
Nevertheless, Captain, we can't stay here forever.
You will have to, Mr. Land. If I let you go, you may tell others the secret of this great submarine. Come, let me show you the rest of this ship.
Captain Nemo took us into the engine room. He showed us the controls that make the ship go up and down. And then he took us into another room and pressed a button.
Look, the walls are moving back. It's another big window.
What a magnificent view. Sponges. Cora, those fish.
When we go down deeper, gentlemen, I believe your meal is ready to be served in the main room.
The captain escorted us back to the main room where the dining table was filled with food. Most of it looked just like the food we ate at home, but we were soon to find this wasn't true.
Oh, this food is delicious, Capitaine. May I ask you how you are able to have such fine food?
These dishes come entirely from my ocean kitchen. There is nothing here of the earth.
This sure tastes like steak and vegetables to me.
The vegetables we get from our own undersea farm. We grow various kinds of seaweed, which my cook fixes up to taste like carrots and cabbage.
Amazing! And the steak?
Brisket of starfish, Professor. Seasoned to taste exactly like sirloin.
Well, what about this? It sure tastes like veal.
Wow! It's a secret cave with an underwater entrance. Flipper, you're terrific. The best hiding place in the world.
Sandy was wrong. The island is not deserted. And now, as the Coast Guard plane flies off to the north, the escaped killers, Gil Bateson, Barney Millard, and Ish Barton, crawl out of a thick clump of bushes. They drag their boat from its hiding place and push it out into the water. At that very moment, a handsome white yacht rounds the bend of the island and comes slowly toward Bateson's rowboat.
Well, what do we got here? That's just what we need, a boat like that. If we can just get on board. I know what we'll do.
Yeah, what?
Yeah, we'll lie down here and pretend we've been drifting for days. Here, like this.
Yeah.
Now, let's hope they fall for it.
Okay.
Flipper has brought Sandy out of the secret cave. Now Sandy peers from behind some rocks at the beautiful white boat. On board the yacht, Sir Halsey Hopewell, his wife Julia, and their two pretty daughters, Gwen and Penny,
are on a long cruise through the Caribbean.
Daddy?
What is it, dear?
There's a boat over there with three men in it.
Oh, yes, I see. I've got them in my binoculars now. They could be those convicts the Coast Guard's been searching for.
They certainly look harmless enough. In fact, they look half dead.
Nevertheless, Penny, go fetch my pistol.
All right, Daddy.
As Sandy watches from his hiding place on shore, the three escaped convicts pretend to be drifting helplessly in their small boat while Sir Halsey steers his yacht alongside and then cuts the engine.
Stanford, so scary.